Rodney Stone by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Dramatized for radio in four parts by Constance Cox. With Sean Arnold as Rodney Stone, Stuart Organ, Henry Stamper, Charlotte Mitchell, John Rye, and Terence Morgan. Rodney Stone, Part 4.
As a result of a mysterious letter from Jim, my uncle, Sir Charles Tregellis, and I found ourselves on the road to Cliff Royal, with the high yellow carriage of Sir Lothian Hume not far behind. Sir Charles whipped up the mares, and now from the curve of the road we could see the high, dark pinnacles of the old manor house shooting up above the ancient oaks which ring it round. The sight of it, with its blood-stained and ghost-blasted reputation, would in itself have been enough to send a thrill through my nerves. But when the words of my uncle made me suddenly realize that this strange summons was indeed for the two men who were concerned in that old-world tragedy, and that it was the playmate of my youth who had sent it, I caught my breath as I seemed vaguely to catch a glimpse of some portentous thing forming itself in front of us. The rusted gates between the crumbling heraldic pillars were folded back, and my uncle flicked the mares impatiently as we flew up the weed-grown avenue until he pulled them on their haunches before the time-blotched steps. The front door was open, and Boy Jim was waiting there to meet us. But it was a different Boy Jim from him whom I'd known and loved. There was a change in him somewhere, a change so marked that it was the first thing that I noticed, and yet so subtle that I could not put words to it. He was not better dressed than of old, for I well knew the old brown suit that he wore. He was not less comely, for his training had left him the very model of what a man should be. And yet there was a change, a touch of dignity in the expression, a suggestion of confidence in the bearing which seemed, now that it was supplied, to be the one thing which had been needed to give him harmony and finish. Somehow, in spite of his prowess, his old school name of Boy had clung very naturally to him, until that instant when I saw him standing in his self-contained and magnificent manhood in the doorway of the ancient house. A woman stood beside him, her hand resting upon his shoulder, and I saw that it was Miss Hinton of Anstey Cross.
Roddy!
Jim, what's happened? What did you mean by that letter?
Yes, Jim. I think you owe me an explanation.
I'll explain everything in time, Sir Charles. But won't you come in? I'd like you to meet someone.
Well, Sir Charles, do you remember me?
I don't think I've had the privilege, ma'am. And yet...
Polly Hinton of the Haymarket Theatre. Surely you haven't forgotten Polly Hinton.
Polly Hinton. Forgotten? Why, we mourned you in Fops Alley for more years than I care to think of. But what in the name of wonder you...
I married Sir Charles and retired from the stage. I want you to forgive me for taking Jim away from you last night.
Then it was you. We saw a woman's footprint.
Yes, Sir Charles. My claim on him was even stronger than yours. You were his patron. I was his mother.
Jim! It's all true, Roddy. There's so much you've got to hear.
He's my own boy, Sir Charles. And he saved me from what is worse than death, as your nephew Rodney could tell you. Long before he knew who I was, he was good and kind to me. But my lips were sealed, and it was only last night that I could tell him that it was his mother whom he had brought back by his gentleness and by his patience into the sweetness of life.
Hush, Mother. There are some things which are best left between ourselves. But tell me, Sir Charles, how went the fight?
Oh, your uncle would have won it, but some roughs broke the ring.
He's not my uncle, Sir Charles, but he has been the best and truest friend, both to me and to my father, that ever the world could offer. I hope he wasn't hurt much.
A week or two will set him right. But I still wish I knew how it was you left me in that manner.
Let me tell it for you, Jim. Though my son, Sir Charles, knew nothing of his parents, we were both alive and had never lost sight of him. When he wished so much to go to London and take up this challenge, I let him have his way and helped him all I could. But yesterday it came to the ears of his father, who would have none of it. He ordered me at once to bring his son to his side.
But I refused, sir. You've been good to me, and I couldn't let you down.
I was at my wit's end, Sir Charles. I knew Jim would never come unless a substitute were provided for him. I went to the good, kind couple who had brought him up and told them how matters stood. Mrs. Harrison loved Jim as if he had been her own son, and her husband loved mine, so they came to my help. Harrison would take Jim's place if Jim would go to his father. Then I drove to Crawley. I found out which was Jim's room and spoke to him through the window. I was sure those who had backed him would never let him go.
No, indeed.
Then I told him everything.
But even then I wouldn't go, sir, until I'd made certain Mr. Harrison would take my place.
But you could have left some message with Belcher. Anyone.
My head was in a whirl, Sir Charles. To find father and a mother, a new name and a new rank might turn a stronger head than mine ever was.
A new rank?
Oh, in a minute, Roddy. My mother's phaeton was waiting, but we'd scarcely started before some fellow seized the horse's head, and a couple of ruffians attacked us. I knocked down the one and beat the other off with his own cudgel. But who they were or why they should molest us, I can't imagine.
Perhaps this gentleman could tell us. Eh, Sir Lothian?
Which is the person who has had the impudence to send me so pressing an invitation to visit my own house?
I am.
Then perhaps you would be so good as to tell me why you're here and what the devil you mean by trespassing on my property.
You'll understand everything in good time, Sir Lothian. If you would follow me in here.
What the deuce is all this poppycock? Jim, it's that room where we came before.
Yes. You remember it too, I think, Sir Charles.
Only too well. Everything is the same. Cards on the table, chairs where we sat, and that stain upon the ceiling. Must we stay in this dreadful room?
My father wished your meeting with him to be here.
You came here and saw your father? Cliff Royle?
Yes.
Well, in God's name, then, tell us who your father is.
Jim made no answer, save to point over our shoulders, and glancing round, we became aware that someone had entered the room through the door which led to the bedroom stair. He was a tall man, clad in a dark dressing gown, and leaning heavily upon a stick. His long, bloodless countenance was so thin and so white that it gave the strangest illusion of transparency. Only within the folds of a shroud have I ever seen so wan a face. The brindled hair and the rounded back gave the impression of advanced age, and it was only the dark brows and the bright, alert eyes glancing out from beneath them which made me doubt whether it really was an old man who stood before us. There was an instant of silence, broken by a deep oath from Sir Lothian Hume.
Lord Avon, the God.
Yes. Lord Avon. At your service, gentlemen.
Ned.
No, Charles. Keep your distance from me.
Ned, is that all you can say to me after all these years? We were the best of friends.
Until you thought me guilty of murder.
No, Ned.
Yes, Charles, you did. I read it in your eyes and in your manner on that terrible morning. At the first breath of suspicion, you, my most intimate friend, set me down as a thief and a murderer.
No, Ned, no.
And so when I wished to leave my son in safe hands, I had to pass you over. I placed him with the one man who had never doubted my innocence.
Harrison. Then Jim is really your son?
Yes. But I kept my marriage secret because I'd married outside our own circles. I loved her dearly, but my foolish pride wouldn't allow me to declare what I had done.
Hush, my dear.
No, it must be told. When through my neglect she was driven into habits for which I, not she, was to blame, I took the child from her and gave her an allowance on condition she kept away from him.
My eyes had been upon the face of my uncle as he listened. But now, as I turned them from him, they fell once more upon the thin, wolfish face of Sir Lothian Hume. He stood near the window, his grey silhouette thrown up against the square of dusty glass. And I have never seen such a play of evil passions, of anger, of jealousy, of disappointed greed upon a human face before.
Am I then to understand that this young man claims to be the heir to the peerage of Avon?
He is my lawful son, and in consequence my heir.
I demand a proof. Neither Tregellis, nor I, nor any of your friends ever heard of a marriage or dreamt that there was any other heir but myself.
My word is proof to those who know me.
Pardon me, Lord Avon. But as your cousin, I may have some claim to know you, and I see no reason why I should accept your statement. To my mind, this is a very pretty conspiracy with a murderer, a play actress, and a prize fighter, all playing their parts. Sir Charles, you will hear from me on the matter between us. And you, my lord, will hear from me again.
He's going to denounce me to the authorities.
Jim, Sir Charles, go after
him. No, let him go. The matter must come into the open now at whatever cost.
Ned, you did me an injustice when you believed I judged you harshly without reason. True, I did believe you guilty, but only on the evidence of my own eyes.
What do you mean?
I saw you, Ned, on that accursed night, coming from your brother's room. I heard his voice rage in anger and fear only an instant before, and then I saw you. You had a bag of money in your hand, and on your face was such an expression that I dared not speak to you. Can you blame me when we made that dreadful discovery next morning for thinking the worst?
And yet, Charles, I am innocent.
I thank God to hear you say so. But why have you concealed yourself all these years?
It was to save the family honor, Charles. You know how dear it was to me. I couldn't clear myself without proving my brother to have been guilty of the foulest crime which a gentleman could commit. For 18 years I have screened him at the expense of everything of which a man could sacrifice. I have lived a living death which has left me an old and shattered man when I'm but in my 40th year. But now, when I'm faced with the alternative of telling the facts about my brother or of wronging my son, I can only act in one fashion. And the more so since I have reason to hope that a way may be found by which what I am now about to disclose to you need never come to the public ear. Come over here. You remember the days and nights we played cards here?
Yes, only too well.
Sit down at the table again, where you sat before. Yes, you were there. I was here. There sat Sir Lothian, and there my brother. Take up the cards before you, Charles.
Yes.
One at a time. Place your finger and thumb at the left-hand bottom corner and tell me what you feel.
But it's been pricked by a pin.
Yes. What is the card?
King of clubs.
Try the left-hand bottom corner of the next one.
Hmm. No, it's quite smooth.
And the card?
Three of spades.
And the next?
Yeah, this has been pricked. It's the ace of hearts.
Don't you see the whole wretched story now?
I see something, but not all.
Edward, this is too much for you.
Yes, Father.
You should rest.
No, no. Now I've begun, I must tell it all. You remember our game, Charles? How we all lost and my brother won? You remember, too, how you all retired and left me in this room alone?
Yes.
Well, I remained here thinking of the incidents of the game and the changes it would make in my fortunes. My only consolation was that my brother had won. I knew he was firmly in the clutches of the moneylenders, and I hoped that the luck which had shaken my position might be the means of restoring his. As I sat there, idly fingering the cards, I suddenly felt the small needle pricks in the corners.
Was every pack so marked?
Every one.
Hmm.
I knew my brother had ordered the packs and that they'd been in his room some hours before we began to play. Tingling with anger and shame, I went upstairs, the cards in my hand, to tax him with cheating. He was sitting with the money before him as I entered. I showed him the cards and I saw the color drain from his face.
Did he attempt to deny his guilt?
He knew it was useless. He pleaded with me, begging me to spare him from public disgrace. I told him that for the sake of the family honor, I would not reveal what he had done, but the money must be returned and he must never touch a card again.
Yes.
The papers he'd won from me, I threw into the grate. As I turned away, he clutched at me, tearing the ruffle from my wrist and crying out that the moneylenders would send him to prison. I refused to say another word to him, but left him groveling on the floor in his self-pity and misery.
That must have been the cry I heard. Then I looked out and saw you coming from his room.
Next morning, I returned the money to you. And then came the discovery of my brother's death.
Mm.
I saw I was suspected. And I saw also that even if I could clear myself, it could only be done by revealing his infamy. I chose to flee my trial and disappear from the world.
Yes, for 18 years.
First of all, it was necessary I should make arrangements for the wife and son, of whom you knew nothing. At that time, there were reasons, now happily gone past, which made me determine the child was better apart from his mother.
You were ashamed of me, Edward. You drove me to it.
I know, Mary. I know now I was to blame.
But why didn't you confide in me, Ned?
Your suspicions had wounded me so deeply. On the evening after the tragedy, I went to London and arranged that my wife should have a fitting allowance on condition that she did not interfere with my son. Then I went to the only person in the world I felt I could trust.
Who is he?
Lord Avon. Open the door, quickly.
Oh, my lord. What in the name of wonder?
Close the door. I must speak to you privately.
Come in here, my lord. We were just going to bed.
Jack?
It's all right, lass.
Oh. Who is it, Jack? Lord Avon.
Did you want the missus to stay, my lord?
Yes, what I have to ask concerns her too. Harrison, my brother, Captain Barrington, was found dead yesterday morning. It would seem he was murdered.
Murdered? Do they know who did it, sir?
No, but it's almost certain that suspicion will light upon me.
You, sir? Oh, but that's impossible. You never murder anyone.
As God's my witness, I'm innocent. But I shall be unable to prove it without disclosing matters I prefer to keep unknown. I need your help, Harrison.
Well, in anything, my lord.
2 years ago, I was married, secretly. My wife and I now live apart, but I have a child, a son of 2 years old.
So?
For certain reasons, I do not wish him to remain with his mother, and I want you and your wife to take charge of him.
We will, of course, if you wish, my lord. And gladly, but for how long, sir?
For good, if necessary. Bring him up as your own. Never tell him of me or his mother.
But, my lord, how can you bear to part with him?
I must, unless by some miracle the truth comes to light. Now, for practical matters, you have, I believe, Harrison, just retired from the prize ring.
Oh, Mrs. Maybe, sir, was after the trouble with Black Baruch.
Yes, they thought Baruch was going to die, my lord, and my poor Jack would have been arrested.
Mm-hmm. What do you intend to do in the future?
I thought of something in the blacksmith's line, my lord, seeing as it takes strength and all I've got is me muscles.
Would you object to going to Friar's Oak?
Oh, where's that, my lord?
Sussex Village, about a mile from my country house, Cliff Royal.
Oh, the quieter the better, my lord. Anything to keep him away from them young London bloods, as they're always trying to get him back to the prize ring.
I'll set you up in business there. And you'll be able to bring me news of my boy.
Where will you be, sir?
At Cliff Royal.
But if that's your country house, sir, won't they come looking for you there?
They'll never find me. There are secret passages there where a man may hide till doomsday.
Uh-huh.
I shall need you to supply me with food, Harrison.
Yes, sir. But when shall we expect the boy, sir?
I have him outside in the carriage now. I'll bring him in to you.
Oh.
I have your word you'll be faithful to me.
Oh, my honour, my lord.
We've never had a child ourselves, sir. We'll bring him up like he was our very own.
And you've been here in this house for 18 years?
Yes. I selected Friar's Oak because I had already chosen my place of concealment. And if I could not see my boy, it was at least some consolation to know that he was near me. You're aware that this mansion is one of the oldest in England.
Hmm.
But you're not aware that it has been built with a very special eye to concealment, that there are no less than 2 habitable secret chambers, and that the outer or thicker walls are tunneled into passages. The existence of these rooms has always been a family secret, though it was one which I valued so little that it was only the chance of my seldom using the house which had prevented me from pointing them out to some friend. Now I found that a secure retreat was provided for me in my extremity. I stole down to my own mansion, entered it at night, and leaving all that was dear to me behind, I crept like a rat behind the wainscot to live out the remainder of my weary life in solitude and misery. In this worn face, Charles, and in this grizzled hair, you may read the diary of a most miserable existence.
My dear friend.
Once a week, Harrison used to bring me up provisions, passing them through the pantry window, which I left open for the purpose. Sometimes I would steal out at night and walk under the stars once more, with a cool breeze upon my forehead.
But this I had to stop at last, for I was seen by the rustics, and rumours of a spirit at Cliff Royal began to get about. One night, two ghost hunters...
It was I, Father, and my friend. Roddy, you remember the night we came here?
Yes.
I know it was. Harrison told me the same night. I was proud, James, to see that you had the spirit of the Barringtons, and that I had an heir whose gallantry might redeem the family blot which I have striven so hard to cover up. Then came the day when your mother's kindness, her mistaken kindness, gave you the means of escaping to London.
Oh, Edward, if you could have seen our boy, like a caged eagle beating against the bars.
I don't blame you, Mary, I don't blame you. But when I learned from Harrison that he'd matched himself to appear in a public prize fight, that I could not allow, Charles.
Ned, how could I know?
Then Edward revealed himself to me, and I went to fetch Jim to his side.
That was yesterday, Charles. I've told you about the past 18 years almost as soon as I've told my wife and son.
Please God, we shall have many years yet in which to make up to you all that you've suffered, Ned. But it seems to me we're as far off as ever from learning how your brother came by his death.
That someone else must tell you, Charles. Someone who was there and witnessed it. Tell him to come in, my son.
Yes, Father.
Someone else?
Will you come in now? Good day, Sir Charles.
Ambrose, for he it was, stepped forward into the light, turning his sallow face in our direction. His usually impassive features were in a state of painful agitation, and he spoke slowly and with hesitation, as though his trembling lips could hardly frame the words. And yet, so strong is habit, that even in this extremity of emotion, he assumed the deferential air of the high-class valet, and his sentences formed themselves in the sonorous fashion which had struck my attention upon that first day when the curricle of my uncle had stopped outside my father's door.
Ambrose! What in God's name are you doing here?
Tell Sir Charles Ambrose what happened on that night, as fully and as freely as you've told it to me.
Very good, my lord. Lady Avon and gentlemen, if I have sinned in this matter, and I freely confess I have done so, I know only one way in which I can atone for it. That is by making the full and complete confession my master, Lord Avon, has demanded.
Confession? Hear him out, Charles.
I assure you, then, that what I am about to tell you is the absolute and undeniable truth concerning the mysterious death of Captain Barrington. It may come as a surprise to you, Sir Charles, that I hated him.
You hated Barrington?
It may seem impossible to you that one in my humble walk of life should bear a deadly and implacable hatred against a man in the position of Captain Barrington. You think that the gulf between us is too wide. I can tell you, gentlemen, that the gulf which can be bridged by unlawful love can be spanned also by an unlawful hatred, and that upon the day when this young man stole from me all that made my life worth living, I vowed to heaven that I should take from him that foul life of his, though the deed would cover but the tiniest fraction of the debt which he owed me. I see that you look askance at me, Sir Charles Tregellis, but you should pray to God, sir, that you may never have the chance of finding out what you would yourself be capable of in the same position.
But why? In heaven's name.
He stole from me.
Stole from you?
Yes, from me. Everything that made my life worth living. I swore that I would take from him that foul life of his in return.
This is unbelievable.
It was a wonder to all of us to see this man's fiery nature breaking suddenly through the artificial constraints with which he held it in check. His short, dark hair seemed to bristle upwards. His eyes glowed with the intensity of his passion, and his face expressed a malignity of hatred which neither the death of his enemy nor the lapse of years could mitigate. The demure servant was gone, and there stood in his place a deep and dangerous man, one who might be an ardent lover or a most vindictive foe.
We were to have been married, she and I, when some black chance threw her across his path.
Yes. I begin to understand.
Yes, a common enough story, is it not, Sir Charles? I don't know by what promises he deceived her. It was done before I knew of the danger. But she was left with her broken heart and ruined life to return to the home into which she brought disgrace and misery.
Did you know of this, Ned?
No, nothing.
I only saw her once after that. But she told me the captain had burst out laughing when she reproached him for his treatment of her. I swore there and then that his blood should pay me for that laugh.
Ambrose.
I was a valet at the time, Sir Charles. I determined to gain service with Lord Avon solely for the purpose of settling accounts with his younger brother.
Go on.
Eventually, I achieved my aim. Then I awaited my chance. It came during the visit of you, Sir Charles, Sir Lothian Hume and Captain Barrington to Lord Avon here at Cliff Royal.
The weekend we played at cards?
Yes, Sir Charles. Lord Avon believed that no one but himself knew of the secret passages in this house. He was mistaken. I knew of them. Or at least I knew enough of them to serve my purpose. I had discovered one that led from my room to that of the captain. In that manner, I could come upon him when I wished and nobody would be the wiser. I then formulated my plan. I was to come upon him by surprise, tell him I knew of his infamy, kill him, and make my escape.
Cold-blooded murder?
To me, my lady, it was justice. While the four of you gambled for 2 days and a night, I awaited my opportunity. Whenever you rang for fresh wine, at what hour you liked, you always found me ready and waiting, counting the minutes which brought me nearer to my man. Captain Barrington even remarked that I was the model of all valets.
Yes. I seem to recall something of this.
Then at last, very early in the morning, I heard you push back your chairs and knew your game had finally come to an end. I entered the room to receive my master's orders. Lord Avon was sitting at the table fingering the scattered cards. He ordered me angrily from the room, but before I obeyed him, I managed to put my hand on the thing I had really come for. Lord Avon's hunting knife, which lay on a side table.
The knife that killed Barrington? You saw nothing of this, Ned.
I just at that moment discovered the marked cards. I'd even forgotten that Ambrose entered the room.
I stole back to my bedroom and sat waiting while I made up my mind what to do. There would be little satisfaction in killing him if he was not to know whose hand struck the blow, or which of his sins it came to avenge.
Ambrose, you're inhuman.
On the contrary, Sir Charles. I thought I might bind and gag him in his drunken sleep, then with a prick of my knife, arouse him to listen to what I had to say to him. I could picture the look in his eyes as the haze of sleep cleared away from them, the look of anger turning to stark horror as he understood who I was and what I had come for. It would be the supreme moment of my life.
Barrington slept within yards of me, and yet I knew nothing of this.
I waited, as it seemed to me, at least an hour. Then I went to my secret passage and made my way to Captain Barrington's room. I slid back the panel a few inches and saw him. He was counting over his gambling gains, his face flushed and triumphant. Then he rose and stumbled towards his bed. I knew it would only be a few minutes before he fell into a deep sleep, and then it would be easy for me.
Ambrose, make an end of this, for God's sake.
As your lordship wishes. I was still watching him when suddenly I saw him start and a terrible expression come into his face. For an instant, I thought I was discovered. Then I heard Lord Avon's voice, and he came into my view. I saw my master spread out the cards on the table and watched the captain blanch with terror as he learned his infamy had been discovered. I saw with joy that my master was deaf to his pleas. I watched Lord Avon sweep the money into a bag and burn the IOUs. Then, As he turned away, I saw the captain seize him by the wrist, imploring him to have mercy on him. How I loved my master when I saw him drag his sleeve from those clutching fingers and leave the stricken wretch groveling on the floor.
This is all as you described it, Ned.
Yes, but now comes the end, which I couldn't tell you, Charles, for I never knew it until now. Tell Sir Charles Ambrose what happened after that.
I waited where I was, watching the captain all the time, and thinking of the opportunities that now opened to me.
Opportunities?
Now I knew the man was a cheat. I had an even better weapon than my master's hunting knife. I could hound him from his clubs and his regiment. I could blast his life completely and still kill him in the end if I so wished.
Ambrose, the man was broken enough.
We all have our own feelings, Sir Charles, and you will permit me to say that a serving man may resent an injury as much as a gentleman, though the redress of the duel is denied him. It was my revenge and mine only which counted with me.
Heaven's sake, man.
After Lord Aidan had gone, the captain remained for a few moments kneeling on the floor, his head in his hands. Then he rose and moved quickly across the room out of my view. I could hear him at a bureau, opening drawer after drawer as if in search of something. For a moment, there was silence. Then from where he stood, there was a cry and the sound of a heavy fall. I stepped into the room. The captain had defeated my purpose. The knife with which he had stabbed himself lay by his side, and as I reached him, he died.
But Lord Avon's knife was found beside him.
That was my fault, Sir Charles. As I came away, I caught up the captain's knife by mistake instead of the one I'd brought with me. Had I known how terribly it might tell against you, my lord, I would have gone back for it.
But you knew the truth of the affair. How could you allow an innocent man to be persecuted all these years?
How could I reveal it, Sir Charles, without revealing the scandal I knew Lord Avon was so anxious to conceal?
He's right, Charles.
But I swore, Sir Charles, that if ever I should find my old master, I'd reveal everything to him. It was your nephew who put me on the track of where he might be found.
I did?
The night, sir, you told Sir Charles of seeing a ghost here.
Of course.
I came here and found Lord Avon.
The day you deserted me, I presume.
I trust you forgive me for that, Sir Charles. But Lord Avon had the prior claim.
They've come to arrest me.
Oh, Ned!
You can prove your innocence now, Father.
In here, Sir James.
I don't need to be shown the way, sir, in a house where I've drunk many a bottle of good claret. Lord Avon, the magistrate of the county of Sussex, it's my duty to tell you that a warrant is held against you for the willful murder of your brother, Captain Barrington, in the year 1786.
I'm ready to answer the charge, Sir James.
Now, this I tell you as a magistrate. But as a man and the squire of Rougham Grange, I'm right glad to see you, Ned, and here's my hand on it. Never will I believe that a man like yourself, who could show his horse's tail to any field in the whole down county, would be capable of such an act.
I'm as innocent as you are, James, and I can prove it.
Until which time? A stout door and a good lock will be the best guarantee that you'll be there to do so.
Are you a magistrate of this county, sir?
No.
Then how dare yourself presume to instruct me in my duty?
I simply ask that Lord Avon is kept in safe custody until this matter is cleared up. I'm the next heir to the estate, and I've reason to believe there's a conspiracy afoot to cheat me of my position.
Plague take it, Ned. I want to deal with you as kindly as possible, but the law obliges me to take you into custody.
Excuse me, Sir James, but isn't it a fact that so long as he's under the eye of a magistrate, he may be said to be in the care of the law?
That is so.
Then, Sir James, if Lord Avon were to stay with you...
Thank you, sir. Thank you for reminding me. You'll stay at my place, Ned, till this blows over. And we'll crack a bottle together, thank you.
James!
In other words, Lord Avon, I make myself responsible to hold you in safe custody until your person is required of me.
Thank you, James. And if my wife and son might visit me...
Oh, is that who they are? Well, then they shall come and stay too. Hang me if they don't.
Thank you, sir.
I'm a boy of your age, of my own lad, and if anyone tried to part him from me... Oh, well... Lady Avon, my hearty greetings to you. You're truly welcome, both of you. My carriage is outside, Ned, and we can go at your pleasure.
Let's go at once, Edward. Away from this horrible house.
Thank you, my dear.
Well, I will look after you.
I'm all right. Yes.
Sir Charles, I want to thank you for being so good to me and for giving me a chance when I thought I needed it. But I know my uncle did better for you than I should have done.
Not better. When Lord Avon claimed his son, the ring lost a great fighter.
I'll be coming to see you, Roddy.
Sir Lothian, you have not forgotten, I hope, there's still a small matter open between us.
I was about to remind you of it. Would you kindly give me the name of a friend so that my second may call on him?
Lieutenant Stone of Friar's Oak will stand for me.
And the time and place of our meeting? Would tomorrow morning suit you?
Oh, the sooner the better.
I agree. Good day.
Are you really going to fight a duel with him, Uncle?
I am.
But he may kill you.
Alternatively, I may kill him. Let us look at the bright side, shall we? Well, well, well. This has certainly been a day of surprises. To think of the old friend not only alive, but innocent as well.
And Jim, his heir.
Yes. Your instinct was right in the choice of a friend, nephew. No relative of mine need be ashamed of his friendship with the son of Lord Avon. Ah. But you're the biggest surprise of all, Ambrose. To think you could break out in such a way.
It will never happen again, sir.
I trust not.
And if I might say so, sir, your cravat pains me very much.
I know, I know. Lorimer does his best, but I've never been able to fill your place.
I should be proud to serve you again, Sir Charles, if you should wish me to.
Oh, but surely, Lord Avon...
He says my presence is painful to him, sir. So, if you could overlook my moment of violence...
I'll overlook anything, so long as you don't desert me again. Now, we're going to Friar's Oak, Ambrose... And on arrival, I shall be vastly obliged if you'll arrange my cravat. Come, Neville.
Read it quickly, please, Father.
Patience, lad. Patience while I get it undone.
What does it say? Is it from Lord Nelson himself?
Not exactly, but nearly as good as. This is what it says. We have great pleasure in confirming the appointment of Mr. Rodney Stone as midshipman of HMS Victory under the command of Admiral Lord Nelson.
Oh, Father.
Then there's a lot of flim-flam.
Lord Nelson? I'm to go in his ship.
Here it is, lad, in black and white.
It seems I've hardly seen you for a moment, Roddy, before I must lose you again.
Hush, Mary, love. It's a great chance for the boy. He'll learn everything about seamanship that's worth knowing. From Lord Nelson.
You've said nothing about yourself, Lieutenant. Hmm? I trust you too have had some share of good fortune in the matter of appointments.
That I have, Sir Charles. I've been appointed to the Cato as post-captain.
Oh, Father!
You well deserve it, Lieutenant. Captain, I should say. I hope you may see you an admiral yet. So, it seems you and I must part company, nephew.
All the Stones have been in the sea service, Charles. But we can never forget your kindness in showing our dear Roddy something of the world.
On the contrary, Mary. I found your son a most excellent companion.
But something of a disappointment to you, sir.
No. You did your best. And it was foolish of me to expect you to measure up to the standards I set myself. Brummel himself could scarcely do that. Now I'm well disposed towards your nephew. And consider you eminently suited to the profession you're about to adopt. Ah... That'll be Sir Lothian's second come to arrange the matter I told you of, Captain. Pray, be so kind as to deal with it.
I will, sir, to the best of my ability.
And while we're on the subject of my nephew, there is one little favour you must grant me. He'll have to have a uniform, I imagine.
Of course he will, Charles. Anson will take him to the naval tailors at Portsmouth.
Pardon me, Mary, he must do no such thing. I've seen some of those naval men walking about in London.
And the cut and fit of their uniforms positively makes one shudder. No, 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 no. You must go to Deeves of Bond Street, nephew.
But, Charles, the cost.
The cost will be borne by me. Mammy Taylor has your measurements, nephew, and will send them to Deeves. You shall have a couple of uniforms even the French might envy.
Thank you, sir.
Ah, Captain. Sir. Is the matter settled?
We've arranged it for 7 o'clock tomorrow morning on Ditchling Common, Sir Charles.
I wish these things could be brought off later in the day. One either has to rise at a perfectly absurd hour or neglect one's toilet.
They're only at the inn across the road, Sir Charles. If you wished, I could step across and arrange it for later.
No, no, no. I must make the effort. Ambrose shall call me at 5.
What is this, Charles? You never told me. Are you about to fight a duel?
A little matter between Sir Lothian and myself, sister, which will be over long before you're even awake. Now, pray don't concern yourself.
And the barometer's set fair. You'll have a fine day for it.
May I come with you, Uncle?
No, no, nephew. One doesn't have spectators at such affairs, and you'll see fighting enough before long. Nor need you look as if you're walking behind a coffin. It's not my first affair, and I dare say it won't be my last.
Anything I can do, Sir Charles?
Yes, Captain. I should appreciate your help in preparing the pistols. I always carry them about. One never knows when an occasion like this might arise.
They're a beautiful pair, and no mistake.
Yes. They've served me well on several occasions.
Perhaps a spot of oil on the trigger would do no harm. That is, if you like a light pull.
I do. Ah, yes, yes. This fits into my hand very neatly. Mm-hmm. It feels as if it were only yesterday that I held it. Yes. Yes, I think I shall manage to find a way to Sir Lothian's waistcoat tomorrow. What's that striking?
It must be 10 o'clock.
Ah. Then if you'll forgive me, Mary, I think I shall retire.
Oh, Charles, I wish you were rising early for a less dangerous errand.
I shall return. Never fear.
Victor, and tell me how dare you touch me.
You better come quickly, sir. We've come the devil of a way for you.
What on earth is that?
Sounds across at the inn.
It's Sir Lothian, Uncle. Two men have got hold of him.
Sir Lothian?
We've got our orders, Sir Lothian. Either you pay or we take you with us.
In heaven's name, can't they give me a little time?
You've had time, and the total's £12,000. Now, are you coming quietly?
Look, Marion, I have a very important appointment for 7 o'clock tomorrow. I'll give you £50 if you'll leave me alone till then.
We got orders to take you with us, and the carriage is waiting.
That's right.
So you'll be so good as to step in, sir.
How can I unless you let go of my arms?
Well, I'll let go, but you keep hold of him. He looks vicious. Would you?
Club him, mate.
Parted him. He won't play no more tricks now. Now, into the carriage with him, my beauty, and into the debtor's jail.
He was hoisted up like a bag of flour and fell with a brutal thud into the bottom of the carriage. The three men sprang in after him, a whip whistled in the darkness, and I had seen the last that I or anyone else, save some charitable visitor to a debtor's jail, was ever again destined to see of Sir Lothian Hume, the once fashionable Corinthian.
Who were they, Uncle?
Sheriff's officers, plainly. He was deep in the hands of the moneylenders.
They struck him. It was horrible.
Is there no hope for him, Sir Charles?
None, I fear. He borrowed enormous sums on the strength of his expectations. But now Lord Avon has an heir. It'll be the finish of him.
You won't need an early call tomorrow after all, Charles.
No, sister. But I wish those men had come a few hours later. I never liked him, but I might have saved him from an ignominious end.
I can't believe it, my lord. I've done nothing to deserve such generosity.
You kept a promise to me faithfully, Harrison. You brought up my son in a way to be proud of.
Well, sir.
Jim wishes this as much as I, don't you, Jim?
Yes, father.
Do you hear it, old girl? We're to live rent-free at a lodge at Cliff Royal, with a pension to keep us for the rest of our days.
Oh, it's good of you, my lord. And I'll be glad to see Jack away from the smithy, and that's a fact.
Aye, aye, aye. You always wanted me away from something. First it's a prize ring, now it's me trade.
What hell?
What's wrong with a smithy, may I ask?
It's those young bloods on the Brighton Road I'm afraid of.
She's afraid they'll entice you back to the prize ring, Harrison.
Aye, and he'd go like a shot, I know, for all he says he wouldn't.
Now,
up at Cliff Royal, you'll be out of their way and out of danger, I'll see to that.
You and me might have a bit of a meal, Master Jim, on a quiet night when nobody was looking. Or wouldn't that be proper?
We'll see, Harrison. Father, I'd like to go and see Rodney Stone. Will you come with me?
No, I promised your mother I'd return at once. But go and see your friend, by all means.
Goodbye, Harrison. This is Harrison.
Goodbye, my lord.
Goodbye, my lord.
And thank you again, sir.
Ah, the old forge. The old anvil. Hammer I used to use.
Oh.
Oh, soon the place will be empty, and it'll be nothing but a memory.
Jim. Sir, I mean... It wasn't so bad with us, was it?
Oh, it was good with you, always. Only, in my bones, I seemed to know it wasn't right for me.
Aye. That was your father's blood in you. It was only natural. But when we come to Cliff Royal, if at any time, sir, I should happen to speak familiar, won't be out of no disrespect, only from custom. And you will forgive me, won't you, sir?
I'd forgive you anything, both of you. You know that.
Oh, there's something else he wants to ask you, sir. Only he's a bit shy about it. Go on, Jack. You know it'll only be on your mind.
Well, sir, it's this. I'm not a morbid man by any means. But there's times when all of us think about the moment when we'll go to our long rest.
Harrison.
Oh, it's all right, sir. I'm not thinking of dying yet. But it's about the place where I'd like to be laid, sir. Now, there's a beautiful bit of turf in the grounds at Cliff Royal. Smooth as a billiard ball. And about 20 foot square.
It's about the size of a prize ring, sir. That's why he's got it on his mind.
Well, what if he is, wife? There's no harm in that, is there? Do you have any objection if I was put there, sir?
None at all. Though I hope it won't be for years yet.
And on the headstone, sir, do you think you could put... He fought a good fight.
Jack, I'm ashamed of you. You're not thinking of the battles of life at all. You're thinking of your fights with Black Baruch and Crab Wilson.
Well, I think it's a good text, Harrison, and one I'd be proud to have myself.
Oh, then you'll do it for me, sir?
Yes, I promise.
Oh, thank you, Jim. Sir, that is. Oh, there's that shoe I left in the furnace when your father comes. It'll be nearly molting by now, I reckon.
Can I help you, Uncle?
Eh? Aye, if you will, boy Jim. For the last time, eh?
Children, nephew, I want to see the back. Ah, yes. Yes, it fits admirably. Deems have excelled themselves. You'll do credit to your ship and me.
Before we part, Uncle, I want to thank you again for your many kindnesses to me. I never really understood your way of life, or fitted into it, but you were always good to me in spite of that.
It was a pleasure to have your company, nephew. You made me think for a short while that it might be pleasant to have a son. Fortunately, the sensation was brief. There are more important things in life for a leader of fashion like myself. But he made quite an impression on me at the time.
Ruddy. Oh, you look splendid in your uniform. I beg your pardon, Sir Charles, but I had to come and say goodbye to Ruddy.
Not at all. I'll leave you to talk with your friend, nephew, while I fetch me curricle from the inn.
Excuse me. When do you go, Ruddy?
In a very few minutes. I'm to join Lord Nelson's ship at Portsmouth.
So this is really goodbye for a long time.
Oh, I shall have leave, Jim. And I'll come and see you if I may, if you won't be too grand for me.
Oh, I'll never be too grand to see my best and truest friend. Isn't it strange, Ruddy, the things that have happened in so short a time?
I always knew you were meant for great things, Jim.
Oh.
When I used to listen to you talking on the Downs, there was something about you that didn't belong to the smithy.
All the same, I'm glad my life began in that humble way. If I'd been Lord Avon's son from the beginning, I'd never have met the people I have. The Harrisons, those great men of the prize ring, and you, Ruddy. I might never even have known you. Now, if I ever feel too proud or I feel my possessions are making me arrogant, I shall go down to the smithy and remember what I once was.
Ruddy, the postchaise is here, and your father is putting your sea chest in. You must take your place inside.
Pardon me, sister, but the nephew's sea chest has just been taken out again.
But Charles, why?
Because this is one further privilege I claim. The privilege of driving the extremely personable nephew down to Portsmouth.
Uncle!
You have no objection, I trust.
There's nothing I'd like better, sir.
It will tell against me, of course, to be seen in a seaport town. But in this case, I shall allow me affections to overcome the better judgment. I'll wait for you while you make your farewells.
Goodbye, Roddy. Take care of yourself, my dear. And come back safe to me.
Goodbye, Mother. Goodbye, Jim.
Goodbye, Roddy. I'll see you when you come back.
Come along, boy. Your uncle's waiting.
The two beautiful mares were waiting, with my uncle, in his many-caped greatcoat, up on the box seat, the reins gathered in his hands. I climbed up beside him and looked at my loved ones once more.
Goodbye, Ruddy.
Goodbye, Ruddy. Goodbye,
Ruddy. I'll see you goodbye, in Portsmouth soon.
Goodbye, Jim.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Mother.
Goodbye.
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 And so I drove away once more from Friar's Oak with my splendid uncle, leaving behind me in the little cottage much that I held dear. But I knew that this time I was going to a better way of life, under the greatest seaman England had ever known, and that I was to play a part, however small, in keeping my dear ones safe from harm. I think my uncle divined something of what was in my thoughts by what he next said to me.
God bless you, nephew. You fight for England.
God bless you, sir, for your good and noble heart.
Come and see me when you return. I shall look forward to a visit from you.
You'll be the first person, sir, after my mother that I shall visit.
Thank you, nephew. Can you use a yard of tin, by the way?
A yard of... you mean the post horn, sir. I've never tried.
Suppose you try now. Why stretch the mare's legs a little?
That was the fourth and final part of Rodney Stone by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized by Constance Cox. With Sean Arnold as Rodney Stone, Stuart Organ as Jim Harrison, Henry Stamper as Champ Harrison, Charlotte Mitchell as Mrs. Harrison, John Rye as Sir Charles Tregellis, and Terence Morgan as Lord Avon. Miss Hinton was played by Jill Borkin, Anson Stone by Peter Woodthorpe, Mrs. Stone by Jean Trenn, Sir Lothian Hume by Nigel Graham, and Ambrose by Michael Bilton. Peter Tuddenham was Sir James Ovington, David Peart, First Officer, and David Goodison, Second Officer. Rodney Stone was directed by David Johnston.